The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. And for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from National Geographic and the News and Observer. Before we begin, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles we're going to be reading on today's Armchair Traveler. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. And on today's Armchair Traveler, we begin our journey diving under the pyramids. This is an article that appears in the July 2022 issue of National Geographic. Writer Nicole Sobecki tells us that the pyramids in Egypt are more famous than the ones in Sudan, and they hide royal burial sites that archaeologists can explore as long as they don't mind diving. Well, let's find out more. I could feel myself suffocating. Each step down the bedrock passageway brought me closer to what I'd long imagined, the pool of khaki water, the flooded tunnel it hid, and the moment I'd have to enter that darkness. The crumbling grandeur of a pyramid loomed above. Here at the ancient necropolis of Nuri in Sudan's northern desert, Kushite royals were laid to rest millennia ago in a series of underground burial chambers beneath mighty pyramids. Now the chambers were flooded with groundwater leaching from the nearby Nile. Archaeologist Pierce Paul Creisman, funded in part by the National Geographic Society grant, was leading a team that would be the first to attempt underwater archaeology below a pyramid. Initially, I'd been calm, even excited, about going along to photograph this ambitious and risky effort in 2020. But as I walked deeper underground, my heart raced, and I could barely breathe. I'd known this existential anxiety before, 9 years ago, from crouching in a drainage pipe in Libya as belt-fed machine guns peppered the ground above. 7 years ago, under attack by Al-Shabaab terrorists in a shopping mall in Nairobi, as pop music eerily played on. 4 years ago, on a lawless beach in Somalia. Here, there was no outward enemy, but something in my own mind screaming at me, "Do not descend." Creisman and dive master Justin Snyder saw my concern. "Give me a moment," I said, holding tightly to my camera, a weight belt slung across my chest. I bit into my regulator and sank cross-legged across the waterline. "Breathe. Just breathe." Surfacing, I nodded to my companions. I was ready. We descended, funneling ourselves through a narrow chute and down the disoriented blackness. Every culture of the world has death traditions to ease the passage of loved ones into the next life and soothe those left behind this one. This 2,300-year-old tomb was the resting place of Natasen, a king who led Kush for nearly two decades. Before him, several of the Kushite kings, known as Black Pharaohs, became so powerful that they ruled all of Nubia and Egypt. Natasen was the last to be buried at Nuri before threats from rivals forced the Kush to move their capital south. They left behind their interred pharaohs. Excavating Nuri, with its treasures hidden underwater, was an especially formidable challenge. A century ago, Harvard Egyptologist George Reisner visited Nuri to explore, among others, the burial chamber of King Taharqa, who ruled all of Egypt in the 7th century B.C. and even earned a mention in the Old Testament for rallying his troops to defend Jerusalem. Many of the other Nuri tombs, though, were left unexplored. The waters have since risen higher, influenced by climate change, the growing agricultural needs of the area, and the modern dams that are transforming the Nile. Since Creisman's work began, Sudan has experienced a coup, a global pandemic, record-setting floods, and a 2019 revolution. When protesters toppled the 30-year dictatorship of Omar al-Bashir, whose government tried to erase Sudan's pre-Islamic history, they chanted the names of Nubian royals. "My grandfather is Taharqa. My grandmother is Kandika, or queen." Bashir is now facing charges at the International Criminal Court. Protesters in the streets denounced the military that grabbed power and sabotaged the country's democratic transition. History long submerged has begun to surface. I swam through a dark channel into the tomb's chambers. Clouds of sediment obstructed all visibility, and despite the small space, it was shockingly easy to get lost and find yourself swimming in circles. A hand connected with mine, and we emerged into the second chamber where the collapsed ceiling resulted in a welcome air pocket. By flashlight, work began. Traditional dirt excavation skills were useless here, so Kreisman's team had to develop new techniques, often on the fly, to uncover the secrets of this overlooked kingdom. Underwater archaeology is now a specialized field, but in its early days, the skills and tools were adapted from shipwreck salvagers and rarely had been used in such tight confines. No room for bulky scuba tanks either, obviously. We breathe instead through sunshine yellow hoses that ran back the way we entered, connecting us to the air above. The risk of a cave-in couldn't be absolutely eliminated, but the entrance was reinforced with 50 linear feet of steel beams, and risk was just not talked about much. Team members looked for anything of interest, gold leaf figurines, pottery, and noted their findings with waterproof boards and markers. A thin cord ran from the third and final burial chamber to the world above, our guide through the darkness. The work acquired a rhythm. Kreisman would descend into the final chamber, which held what might have been Natassin's unopened sarcophagus. A few minutes later, he'd return with a filled bucket. It would be carried outside to team members who'd examine and sort its contents. About an hour into this routine, Kreisman surfaced in the second chamber, took a breath, and called out, "Shabti!" He tenderly lifted the funerary figurine for us to see. Gazing at it in his palm, I realized my breath had slowed to normal and my mind had cleared. The carved man was broken down the middle, but retained his dignified, dutiful expression. He looked ready to fulfill his destiny. Thousands of years ago, a span so long I can't even really fathom it, the figures were believed to revive in order to serve their masters in the afterlife. Now, here I was in the underworld with them. My fear washed away and awe flooded in. In my line of work, I've had a few opportunities like this. The experience an ancient marvel, as most people will never see, and to photograph it for the world to see. I focused on the glistening, wet Shabti. The camera shutter blinked, making the ephemeral permanent. Natassin had rested here in darkness for 2 millennia, kept company by hundreds of tiny caretakers. Soon I'd return to the world above with its impossibly blue skies, but not yet. First, I shot frame after frame, freezing this place in time and willing myself to remember those things in time and beyond my ability to capture. Wow. By the way, Nicole Sabeki is a photographer as well as a writer and is based in Nairobi, Kenya. We're going to leave the pyramids of Sudan and go to Egypt, where Associated Press writer Sammy Magni reveals that Egypt is betting on recent finds of ancient artifacts to boost tourism. Now, this article appeared in the May 29, 2022 edition of the News and Observer. Dateline Cairo. Workers dig in ferry wheelbarrows laden with sand to open a new shaft at a bustling archaeological site outside of Cairo, while a handful of Egyptian archaeologists supervise from garden chairs. The dig is at the foot of the Step Pyramid de Djoser, arguably the world's oldest pyramid, and is one of the many recent excavations that are yielding troves of ancient artifacts from the country's largest archaeological site. As some European countries reopen to international tourists, Egypt has already been trying for months to attract them to its archaeological sites and museums. Officials are betting that the new ancient discoveries will set it apart on the mid- and post-pandemic tourism market. They need visitors to come back in force to inject cash into the tourism industry, a pillar of the economy. But like countries elsewhere, Egypt continues to battle the coronavirus and is struggling to get its people vaccinated. The country has up until now received only 5 million vaccines for its population of 100 million people, according to its health ministry. In early May, the government announced that 1 million people had been vaccinated, though that number is believed to be higher now. In the meantime, authorities have kept the publicity machine running, focused on the new discoveries. In November, archaeologists announced the discovery of at least 100 ancient coffins dating back to the Pharaonic late period and the Greco-Ptolemaic era, along the 40 gilded statues found 2,500 years ago after they were first buried. That came to a month after the discovery of 57 other coffins at the same site, the necropolis of Saqqara, that includes the Step Pyramid. Saqqara is a treasure, said Tourism and Antiquities Minister Khalid El Anani, while announcing the November discovery, estimating that only 1% of the site contains has been unearthed so far. Our problem now is we don't know how we can possibly wow the world after this, he said. If they don't, it certainly won't be for lack of trying. In April, Zahi Hawass, Egypt's best-known archaeologist, announced discovery of a 3,000-year-old lost city in southern Luxor, complete with mud brick houses, artifacts, and tools from pharaonic times. It dates back to Amenhotep III of the 18th dynasty, whose reign, 1390 to 1353 BC, is considered a golden era for ancient Egypt. The discovery was followed by a made-for-TV parade celebrating the transport of 22 of the country's prized royal mummies from central Cairo to their new resting place in a massive facility farther south in the capital, the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization. The Red Sea Resort of Sharm el-Sheikh is now home to the Archaeological Museum, as is Cairo's International Airport, both opened in recent months. And officials also have said they still plan to open the massive new Grand Egyptian Museum next to the Giza Pyramids by January, after years of delays. Entrance fees for archaeological sites have been lowered, as has the cost of tourist visas. The government has for years played up its ancient history as a selling point, as part of a years-long effort to revive the country's battered tourism industry. It was badly hit during and after the popular uprising that toppled longtime autocrat Hosni Mubarak and the ensuing unrest. The coronavirus dealt it a similar blow, just as it was getting back on its feet. In 2019, foreign tourism's revenue stood at $13 billion. Egypt received some 13.1 million foreign tourists, reaching pre-2011 levels for the first time. But in 2020, it greeted only 3.5 million foreign tourists, according to Minister Al-Anini. At the newly opened National Museum of Egyptian Civilization, Mohamed El-Raiz, a tour guide, was leading a small group of European tourists at the hall housing the royal mummies. 2019 was a fantastic year, he said, but Corona reversed everything. It is a massive blow. Tourism traffic strengthened in the first months of 2021, El-Anani, the minister, told the Associated Press in a recent interview, though he did not give specific figures. He was optimistic that more would continue to come year-round. Egypt is a perfect destination for post-COVID, and our tourism is really an open-air tourism, he said. But it remains to be seen if the country truly has the virus under control. It has recorded a total of 14,950 deaths from the virus and is still seeing more than 1,000 new cases daily. Like other countries, the real numbers are believed to be much higher. In Egypt, though, authorities have arrested doctors and silenced critics who question the government's response, so there are fears that information on the true cost of the virus may have been suppressed from the beginning. Egypt also has had a trying experience early on in the pandemic when it saw a coronavirus outbreak on one of its Nile River cruise boats. It first closed its borders completely until the summer of 2020, but later welcomed tourists back, first to the Red Sea resort towns and now to the heart of the country, Cairo and the Nile River Valley, that hosts most of its famous archaeological sites. Visitors still require negative COVID-19 test results to enter the country. In a further cause for optimism, Russia said in April that it plans to resume direct flights to Egypt's Red Sea resort towns. Moscow stopped the flights after the local Islamic State affiliate bombed a Russian airliner over the Sinai Peninsula in October 2015, killing all on board. Amanda, a 36-year-old engineer from Austria, returned to Egypt in May. It was her second visit in 4 years. She visited the Egyptian Museum, the National Museum of Egyptian Civilization in Islamic Cairo, in the capital's historic center. She had planned to come last year, but the pandemic interfered. Once they opened, I came, she said. It was my dream to see the pyramids again. El-Raiz, the tour guide, says that while he's seeing tourists starting to come in larger numbers, he knows a full recovery will not happen overnight. It will take some time to return to before Corona, he said. A travel venue is now going to change from archaeological digs to exploring space. No doubt you're familiar with the latest news about the Artemis moon launch. It has been delayed, unfortunately. The two attempts in September failed because of engine failure, and now it's going to take a couple of weeks to figure out what the problem is before they try to reset the launch schedule, most likely sometime in October. Anyway, Artemis is part of NASA's long-term plan to develop a manned moon base in hopes of using it one day as a launch site for manned flight to Mars. Russia and China are also seeking similar lunar outposts, so it will be interesting to watch how space exploration unfolds in the coming months and years. Now, one interesting aspect of the NASA project that we discovered is a group of blind veterans that are going to get to witness the Artemis moon launch. Reporter Olivia Lloyd first wrote a story for the South Florida Sun Sentinel, and then it was published in the August 28, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. And again, this was before all the launches that got scrubbed, and so some of that we will correct as we go. The dateline is Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Anyone who's ever heard the deep rumble of a spaceship's takeoff knows a rocket launch is a sensory-rich experience. That's part of the reason why a group of 40 blind veterans are heading to Kennedy Space Center next week, and again, that was for the first launch, to experience the Artemis 1 launch in person in coordination with Wisdom for the Blind and NASA, the National Aeronautics and Space Administration. The group will be able to hear it and feel the ground shake as this new rocket, which is one of the largest rockets ever built, will lift off and take the payload, said Benjamin Keeley, the co-founder of Wisdom for the Blind. So your other senses are going to take over, and your brain is going to put that whole picture together. The first ship in the Artemis mission series was scheduled to launch on Monday, August 29th, and it was delayed until the following Friday, and now, again, has been scrubbed indefinitely until they can repair the engine problem. And so its basic mission is to return humans to the moon, and NASA says the unmanned mission around the moon, which this particular flight is about, is going to be the first test of Space Launch System ship, and it's going to be carried into space on the most powerful rocket ever built, boasting 8.8 million pounds of thrust. So that gives you some idea why they're so concerned about the engine and making sure it does not fail. I might not visually be able to see it, but I know this is going to be an experience like no other, and I'm thankful and so appreciative, said veteran Joseph Blake Deloach of West Palm Beach, who's going to be part of the group. Keeley and a friend at NASA who is also blind came up with the idea to organize a visit for a group of blind veterans to witness the launch. Keeley and co-founder of Wisdom for the Blind, Doug Cram, have been coordinating this effort for a little under a year. Cram recalled watching the moon landing on TV with his family in 1969, so he's looking forward to experiencing a launch that will eventually help get humans back to the lunar surface. We've always had a lot of pride in NASA and our country, said Cram, who served in the Army and now lives outside Ocala. And I'm so very excited about going down to Titusville. I won't be able to see the rocket lift off, but I'll be able to hear it. The group of veterans will stay at a hotel in Titusville before taking a bus to Kennedy Space Center in Cape Canaveral for the launch itself. Most of the veterans are from Florida, Keeley said, although veterans nationwide were invited. Several World War II veterans will be part of the group. NASA will be giving the veterans a tour and setting them up in a good spot for the launch. Cram and Keeley both lost their sight during their military service. In response to the inaccessibility of some Veterans Affairs services, they founded Wisdom for the Blind. They intended their organization's website to function as an informational portal. My partner, Doug Cram, and I, we got frustrated that there wasn't one place that veterans who are also vision impaired or blind can go to find the information they need to navigate through the VA and learn about these different resources that are available, Keeley said. Keeley, who currently lives in Fort Lauderdale, has had a lifelong interest in space. He even wanted to be an astronaut when he was a kid, but he said he couldn't due to his imperfect eyesight. Instead, he joined the Navy. Staff Sergeant Deloach had a similar lifelong experience or interest going to a rocket launch. While serving in Afghanistan in 2010, he lost his sight after a grenade struck his vehicle. It's going to sound kind of odd, but one of the things I'm really looking forward to is being able to being around that many intelligent people, Deloach said. I look forward to meeting and talking to them. And again, just feeling it when that shuttle takes off. Man, it's going to be a rush. Deloach will be attending the launch with his wife, Lauren, who is a blind rehabilitation specialist. She said the hands-on nature of the tour is a good accessibility feature, and hopefully she can give good descriptions to her husband for anything he can't access visually. In addition to the tour and meeting the intelligent people at NASA, Deloach is excited for the conversations with other veterans. I'm definitely looking forward to meeting other veterans and just talking to them, hearing their stories, hearing how they've progressed through their challenges and things like that, and sharing my story, Deloach said. Wisdom for the Blind is planning future events, including a prospective fishing trip out of Clearwater. The rocket launch will mark the first time they've done something like this, and Keeley said it's been a learning experience. This is the first one, so we're crawling and learning, but we're ready for the next one, he said. Monday's two-hour launch window starts at 8:33. If the launch doesn't happen Monday, again, that was in August, it will be rescheduled to the following Friday, and again, that one was scrubbed, too. Even if it gets delayed or anything, the fact that an opportunity like this is being presented, I think that more people need to be aware of something like this, Deloach said. For anyone that can't make it to Cape Canaveral, NASA will air the event online, so you can go online, just check out NASA, and they'll have more information when they finally reschedule the Artemis launch. Well, like Staff Sergeant Deloach, many people would like to consider space travel. Going to the moon and back was the highlight of NASA's Apollo program, you may recall. That was years ago. Then we transitioned into unmanned exploration, and we used satellites, robotics, and a host of other new technologies. The Artemis program goal to put astronauts on the moon, and as a recent NASA handout states, NASA has identified the 13 regions at the moon's south pole where it would like to land astronauts as part of its Artemis program. Washington Post writer Christian Davenport has more details in a story that was published in the August 21st, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. And as he writes, NASA has yet to launch the rocket that would carry the astronauts to the moon, and it hasn't yet selected the crew that would explore the lunar surface as part of its Artemis program. But it has already identified where on the moon the astronauts would land. The space agency announced on Friday, August 19th, that it has selected 13 possible regions at the south pole of the moon where there is ice in the permanently shadowed craters, and is a long way from the territory explored by Neil Armstrong and the other Apollo astronauts. The first human mission to land on the moon in some 50 years, now scheduled for as early as 2025, and would be the first crewed lunar landing since the last Apollo mission, which was in 1972. Unlike Apollo, Artemis is designed to create a permanent presence on and around the moon, and NASA has forged ahead with a sense of urgency as China also aims to send astronauts to the moon, and I might inject Russia has also ambitions in that regard. In a briefing Friday, NASA officials said they chose the landing sites using data from the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, a robotic spacecraft that has been mapping the lunar surface since 2009, as well as other studies of the moon. NASA had already announced it was going to return to the lunar south pole, but the specific sites, rather, all in a cluster of 6 degrees latitude of the south pole were chosen, NASA said, because they provide safe landing spots that are close enough to permanently shadowed regions to allow crew to conduct a moonwalk there as part of their 6.5-day stay on the moon. That, NASA said, would allow astronauts to collect samples and conduct scientific analysis in an uncompromised area, yielding important information about the depth, distribution, and composition of water ice that was confirmed at the moon's south pole. Water is an important thing to sustain human life, but also it's a component in parts, hydrogen, oxygen, that can be used for rocket propellant. The Apollo missions went to the equatorial regions of the moon, where there are long stretches of daylight for as long as 2 weeks at a time. The South Pole, by contrast, may only have a few days of light, making the missions more challenging and limiting the windows when NASA can launch. It's a long way from the Apollo site, said Sarah Noble, Artemis Lunar Science Lead. Now we're going somewhere completely different. Her announcement comes as NASA again was preparing for its first mission that was scheduled for August 29th. And, of course, all of these have now been scrubbed until they can get the engine problems resolved. And NASA would like to send the Orion crew capsule without any astronauts on board into orbit around the moon for a 42-day mission as part of this program. So a lot of things in play here as we await for the next launch schedule to be announced. Already we're gaining new insights about space and its seemingly endless array of stars, planets, asteroids, and astronomical features. New Images of Young Galaxy Defy Astronomers' Theories is a story that's written by Joel Achenbach of the Washington Post, and it was published in the August 28, 2022 online edition of the News and Observer. Here's some excerpts for you. The James Webb telescope, performed splendidly as it examines the universe, has got astronomers scratching their heads now. The very distant universe looks a little different than they expected. The telescope, launched 8 months ago and orbiting the sun about 1 million miles from Earth, has been capturing images of extremely faint galaxies that emitted their light in the first 1 billion years or so after the Big Bang. Observing these early galaxies is one of the main missions of the telescope, to see deeper into space and further back in time than any previous telescope. The first scientific results have emerged in recent weeks, and what the telescope has seen in deepest space is a little puzzling. Some of those distant galaxies are strikingly massive. General assumption has been that early galaxies, which formed not long after the first stars ignited, would be relatively small and misshapen. Instead, some of them are big, bright, and nicely structured. The models just don't predict this, Garth Illingworth, an astronomer at the University of California at Santa Cruz, said of the massive early galaxies. How do you do this in the universe at such an early time? How do you form so many stars so quickly? This isn't a cosmological crisis. What's happening is a lot of fast science conducted in real time, as astrophysicist Jehan Karteltip of the Rochester Institute of Technology puts it. Data from the new telescope is gushing forth, and she's among the legions of astronomers who are spinning out new papers, posting them quickly online in advance of peer review. The Webb has seen things no one has ever seen in such a sharp detail and at such tremendous distances. Research teams across the planet are looking at publicly released data and racing to spot the most distant galaxies or make other remarkable discoveries. Science often proceeds at a stately pace, advancing knowledge incrementally. But the Webb is dumping truckloads of enticing data on scientists all at once. Preliminary estimates of distances will get refined upon closer examination. Karteltip says she is certainly not worried about any tension between astrophysical theory and what Webb has seen. We might be scratching our heads one day, but a day later, all this makes not sense, she says. What has surprised astronomer Dan Coe at the Space Telescope Science Institute are the number of nicely shaped disc-like galaxies. We thought the early universe was this chaotic place where all these clumps of star formation, and things are all a jumble, Coe said. That assumption about the early universe, due in part to observations by the Hubble Space Telescope, which revealed clumpy, irregularly shaped early galaxies. So there's a lot more to learn about our universe as these telescopes are revealing. So we'll probably do some more space traveling in future episodes of Armchair Traveler. For now, that's it on today's journey of Armchair Traveler. I hope you've enjoyed it and that you'll join us again next time. I'm Mike Edwards, and I've been reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. And I want to remind you, the content of our program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. By the way, Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. Again, that's ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, just call us at 919-832-5138. The number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.